Il-program li ser tisimaw u għamiġjub li l-kombixu għatajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very happy to have on the program today Giuseppe Schembri Bonacci. Dr. Schembri Bonacci, originally trained as a lawyer, LLM and LLD, and also a PhD in international law. However, at a certain point in his life, his artistic interests overtook those legal interests, and he is now, in fact, a lecturer in the Department of Fine Arts. Dr. Schembri Bonacci is, of course, is an artist in his own right, but today we'll mostly be talking about publications that he has put together, researched and published about various Maltese artists, particularly sculptors. Perhaps we could have a little bit of a general chat about how that takeover of the arts really took place. Obviously, you must have always been interested in
arts. Yeah, of course, yeah. That's very true. Well, it came out, I think the source is an international treaty between me and my father, really, after a whole warring period. Because, I mean, I was always interested in the arts. I used to go to the Malta School of Arts. I used to go to, of course, I used to attend art lessons during my primary and my secondary school, etc., education. But, of course, my parents were a bit worried, as usual. So we came to an agreement that as long as I would keep on developing my professional career, then my parents wouldn't prohibit the artistic streak, which is a bit strange because I come from a whole, I mean, all my family is coming from an art, musical really, world. But anyway, so I continued this double life really. I mean, I studied at universities, I became a lawyer, I practiced as a lawyer. I'm still interested and still working as a lawyer, but from a purely academic, philosophical point of view. I'm very much interested in philosophy of law, philosophy of international law, and I'm keeping up really up to date as to this part of my character, of my professional character.
Because in fact, I mean, to do a PhD in international law, uh-huh, you must have a passion for the subject,
exactly,
because you just don't do a PhD without having that passion.
And I'm still interested. I still keep up to date. I still study. I still, very rarely, but I still cooperate with my lawyer friends, and I still have certain connections with the legal world, of course, something which I would never, of course, opt out from. But slowly, as you said, the art world, the art scene started to overpower my whole life, really. And now it has become the most important, not the only, but the most important activity.
And in fact, now it has become your,
yes,
second profession, really.
Well, now
you're an academic
really,
here at the,
yeah,
university.
Yeah, I mean, that's also another thing, because for me, art used to be the practical side of it. I'm an artist myself, I used to accept, etc. Again, slowly, destiny pushes you into waves which you don't have any control over, right? And I'm going back really to my childhood love, really, in the sense that I've always loved philosophy. And I think even from all my dissertations, my PhD dissertation, my LLM dissertation, my LLD dissertation, are all philosophical. Philosophy of law, philosophy of international law, even my art studies. I studied parallel with my legal, with my law studies. I used to study parallelly in institutes of art. And again, the philosophical side of the question was the most important thing, something which now I'm trying to delve into all my in my publications, really.
And you have wide interests as far as arts are concerned. I mean, you're as you say, as we said, you're an artist yourself, but you're interested in theatre.
Exactly.
And
music, literature. Mm. I mean, the only sad thing I have, really, I hope that, I mean, our listener, your listeners, really won't think that I'm being slightly pretentious, but my great worrying moment is that I won't finish reading what I would like to finish reading before I die. That's the most important thing, because I'm really in love.
Well, the list is probably very long.
Yeah, that's why. Don't say it.
I know what you mean. No, it's, but I think that's a good ambition. Why not?
I really engulf myself. I think reading literature from all sectors, really.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's from, I always analyze everything from a philosophical point of view. Even cinema, I'm not interested in a normal, let's put it this way, film, if I'm not going to tackle it from a philosophical point of view. In fact, my favorite expression to express what I'm trying to say is, look, if a film doesn't provoke a headache, a real headache, I'm not interested in.
If you just go around a gallery looking at the various paintings, even if you just plummeted, sort of parachute into any gallery anywhere in the world, the philosophical questions bounce back at you
across
from the paintings.
And that's how it should be, really, yeah.
What about some of the books that you have published? What would you like to speak about first?
Well, I mean, I can just introduce my APAP, The Descent from the Cross. Well, I've just told you that I mean, watching a film, for me, I mean, if it doesn't provoke a headache, I'm not interested in it. So, of course, I'm trying to give headaches to others. So
how kind.
So my APAP, The Descent from the Cross, is really a philosophical study of APAP's fantastic work, really, and it created a lot of discussion, despite all headaches, etc.
Describe it to us a bit.
Well, this work, we're not discussing APAP as a person, as an artist. I'm not interested in the biographical details and the chronological, these things are important. I'm not minimizing their importance, but I'm much more interested in the analytical part. So I choose a work. This time I chose his Descent from the Cross. And of course I started to analyze the whole historical, analytical, comparative situation as to the Descent from the Cross, beginning from Byzantine times till today, the iconic, and how APAP decided to choose certain elements and why.
Mm. Well, what informed his decisions
exactly.
To do so.
Mm-hmm. And I came to a very strange, beautiful conclusion, in my opinion, which created some sort of discussion and debate, that APAP was in fact passing through a very, very, very dubious, enigmatic rebellion against religion and against even his turbulent relationship with God. Something which, for me, from a philosophical point of view, is the most beautiful thing that can ever exist. I mean, that's why the headache is important. But I was concluding all this not from biographical details, no, but from studying the work and how he chose and which manner he wanted to choose the descent of Christ, right? And this is how I love analyzing. Then I gave quite a detailed philosophical voyage of the various evolutionary elements of this theme, this genre, this descent from the cross. So that was one of the main elements.
Fascinating. And this work, where is this this work actually?
It's a private collection, yeah. And I was lucky that, I mean, this particular person, I mean, invited me quite often to study this particular work. And
what were the elements, though? I'm interested in what you were saying about the turbulent relationship that you've gathered from the work rather than from his bio. But what were the main elements? I mean, obviously, we don't have the whole program to talk about it, but that gave you an inkling that was what was going on in APAP's
because,
mind.
Because one of my main disciplines within, even academic, I would say, because I studied icon art and religious art quite professionally, really. So I can understand the development of the iconography, of Christian iconography, which, and as you said, we don't have time, which APAP's Descent from the Cross negated all. I mean, all values, all artistic values, which were present in all the evolutionary development of this theme, the Descent from the Cross. When I started to compare APAP's Descent from the Cross with all the other Descents from the Cross existing, and again, going from even on the theological side What does the cross mean? Where is the cross? What does light mean? Where is up? Up's light. Where are the persons? Who are the persons involved? The positioning, the positioning of the person, which absolutely changed. Now, this can be just a sporadic choice, which would reflect also a certain type of attitude towards a theme, a religious theme. And so, when I grouped all these values, traditional values, of course, I saw that here, Apap is...
I cut through them completely.
Yes, exactly. And so, I mean, I'm much more interested, of course. I'm not... No, it is important to understand turbulences of a person. Right? Of course, it's important, the philosophical side, the theological side, etc. But what I'm interested in is how one can come to such a conclusion from an artistic point of view. That's my most important element.
Before going on to the next publication, a word about, though, about the biography, in a way, of Apap. I mean, this is a Maltese artist who's obviously extremely well-known, had very well-known works here. His training, I mean, where did he have his training?
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk about our mid-20th century, earlier, 20th century artists, all artists were, first of all, they had a very good grounding in Malta, really. And the majority, if not all, continued their studies either in Naples and in Rome, in a nutshell. What is interesting also for me personally is the socio-political relationship of the artists, not just between themselves, but between their works and society, something which is interesting in the sense that all our artists were studying in Rome in pre-Second World War, in fascist Italy. So this is also another important element in my studies and the research. I'm very much interested in studying the relationship between the artist and the state. I mean, it's my love of my life in my research. Maybe this is due to the fact that I studied and lived for 25 years in the Soviet Union. And so it was one of the most important central elements in life, not just in the academic academic side. It's a very important, reading Bulgakov, for example, Molière, which is also very important, Grossman's Life and Fate. This relationship, how does an artist, Molière's The Sun God, how does an artist react to a tragic situation? And of course, when I used to, and I'm still studying Apap, Cremona's and other artists, our masters, how how they reacted, or their lack of reaction also is important. While studying in fascist Italy, the relation when they came back, how the relationship, the British, of course, and the victorious side now, sort of had a different relationship with these artists. Well, it's very problematic, but completely and deeply interesting. And in my studies, I have to introduce these elements in multi-scholarship. I mean, I'm fortunate that these elements were not studied before, so I'm introducing...
But new ground.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not saying that, look, this is the first time. Of course, there were other important authors and philosophers and scholars who mentioned and who gave a quantitative analysis of what I'm saying, but what I'm trying to introduce is a new qualitative analysis of this situation, besides the other analytical parts. It's important to study the artist not just from a quantitative analytical approach, but we have to see them in their context and the relationship between the context and the content of their work, something which I did in my second publication, Apap, Cremona and St. Paul.
In fact, you mentioned Cremona. Cremona is another very familiar name, of course,
and the master of masters also.
And what was this book actually looking at, the Apap, Cremona and St. Paul?
And this book created a whole heated debate, really, because I was studying how Apap and Cremona reacted or related to the iconography of St. Paul. But I added a very, within inverted commas, what was interpreted as a provocative link in the early 1960s, that is during the Maltese political church religious Malta Liberal Party situation. So I wanted to study, I mean, APAP, Cremona, painting St. Paul for the St. Paul festivities. During, of course, the most...
Troubled
moments during Malta's birth into becoming a modern state.
So we're talking just before independence.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when we had the
discussions
problem,
going on and
and the tense struggle between the Malta Labour Party and the Church, which was central to this particular book, because St. Paul became an emblem, of course, of the anti-Malta Labour Party side, and how Cremona tackled the situation, and how APAP. So you would see APAP's St. Paul has a rather enigmatic feeling, you know, turbulent. He gives a very beautiful St. Paul. It gives a very beautiful situation, the shipwreck thing, I mean, the viper event. But if you study the face of St. Paul, you'll find a very, very, very troubled, philosophical face, but quite uncertain as to what St. Paul, this great military philosopher of Christianity, is going to do. So, I mean, having painted this for the 1961, of course, it means a lot. Now, what did Cremona do? Cremona, not painted really, he created a fantastic St. Paul with Tertua. Tertua is this brittle material.
It's a natural product? Or
yeah, it's a plastic thing. Mm-hmm. Not natural. Well, it's a film. It's a film thing, you know? But he created this fantastic St. Paul, but contrary to APAP, he chose a militant, strong, super. In fact, I compared Cremona St. Paul to the Soviet and fascist, you know, these socialist realist monuments, you know, these fascist monuments, which are quite, artistically, are quite similar. And the St. Paul is still at the Catholic Institute. It's a beautiful St. Paul. Eh? But here you find two St. Pauls being depicted in a different manner within a turbulent religious war, right? Religious struggle. And both St. Paul's, of course, were consciously used in that particular struggle. In fact, St. Paul was one of the most important emblems during the grave sin period. It is important for us to study the context of this. Otherwise, and I'd like to add here that it's unfortunate that Cremona St. Paul is passing today. It's passing a very turbulent for itself. Unfortunately, nobody is taking care, nobody is maintaining.
Is there a way of restoring it?
I'm sure there is, yes. I'm sure there is. But unfortunately, as many things happen in Malta, excuse my expression, I mean, these things are quasi left bypassed. And it's a beautiful work, but it's very brittle. It's there too.
That would be a pity. We have experts now, thank goodness, here, who would probably be able to do something about it.
I would love it if your program would.
Perhaps we can highlight this, and perhaps somebody can think about what can be done.
Exactly.
And it's interesting to hear you say that there was a discussion after your book was published.
Oh yes, there was a heated discussion, really. Yes,
in the newspapers
in my organized launches of the book, in public talks. But this is what I love, really.
How things should be. That's what academics are for, really.
In fact, I even had a very interesting discussion with Cremona's daughter, really, because she had some apprehension of why I'm putting Cremona into such a niche. But then after the discussion, I think things went out quite well.
Your other book, just very quickly, because I'd like to talk about your latest one as well, the Velázquez Picasso.
Oh, yes.
Do tell us about that. I simply love that Velázquez painting.
This book, in fact, was born, as many of the things I do, really, from a struggle again, from a troubled conflict between me and Dr. Marjorie Trusted, senior curator at the Victoria Albert Museum. No, we're very good friends. We're very, very close friends. But we were discussing Las Meninas, Velázquez, and I was discussing Picasso's Las Meninas, because Picasso created variations on Velázquez's Las Meninas. So we're discussing whether Picasso succeeded in sort of emulating or overshadowing, etc. Although I think that Velázquez's work is much stronger. Well, I mean, it's very difficult to go to this hierarchical comparison, but so, I mean, to cut a long story short, we decided to tackle this question in the sense that she would write a part of the book trying to analyze Velázquez Las Meninas, and I would reply by counter-reacting to Velázquez Las Meninas by introducing Picasso's variations. And this evolved into a very, I think, important book. We also roped in Antonio Sparzani from Milan, an authority. And so I really love this international cooperation. I really love it, you know. I mean, trying to discuss a Spanish Baroque and a Spanish modern artist of international repute, both written and analyzed by a senior curator at the Victor Albert Museum, one another, Antonio Sparzani from Milan, and me coming from the University of Malta, it creates quite a beautiful... It took 2-3 years to finalize it, because we had lots of discussions.
Beautiful. Perhaps we'd better go to your latest publication, because yes. Time is running out. That was Anton Ajous and Gothic Socialist Realism. Yes. We're all very familiar with the sculptures that you exactly, speak about yeah. in this book.
Well, again, with Anton Ajous, as with Cremon and Dapap, I prefer the analytical approach. So the analytical approach is based on critical analysis. The context, again, and the content, the relationship between the context and the content. And of course, after studying a lot, trying to go deeper, trying to understand what Ajous is trying to do, intention-wise, context-wise, content-wise, slowly I started to find out, first of all, his relationship with Gothic art, which was a really beautiful surprise for me. I mean, many of his works, as I tried to analyze in my book, have these parallelisms with medieval European art. This has already created quite a lot of discussion, really.
You do mention a few of his sculptures, just to remind listeners
of his main works. He was very prolific, but at least to remember, I mean, the Emcida Workers' Monument, right? The Manuel de Mec Castile. You have the Jamaica's Union corner.
Sette Junior.
Then you have the Sette Junior, which has now been, it used to be at the main guard, right? Piazza
San George.
Now it has been transferred to the gardens. I forgot. Hastings,
that's
okay.
Right.
No, I mean, we've got the Freedom Monument at Birgo, at Born Birgo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, That's Anton Ajous, because I try to discuss him also in the sense from his, as I keep saying, from the social content. He was very much influenced by socialist realism. I mean, his Manuel de Mec is a beautiful novel replica of the Soviet Lenin monument.
In fact, even I, who I'm certainly no expert, can sort of recognize that,
yes.
the movement of it.
Oh, well, I'm not saying this from a negative point of view, no. Of course,
no.
In the arts, you find these mutual influences, of course. And in fact, I do consider his Manuel de Mec as the most important monument in Anton Ajous. On the other side, I do find, as I try to analyze in the book, I find him so inconsistent. Either you have a Manuel de Mec work, which is brilliant in my opinion, but then you have, to put it mildly, unsuccessful works, you know? So it was very, very difficult for me, but challenging, to try to analyze this strange dichotomy. I mean, take the Emcida Monument. You have a fantastic base, quite Gothic, by the way. Fantastic.
There's reliefs on the side.
It could have come out from the Chartres Cathedral in France. You know, it's beautiful. And then he decided to put these two bronze figures, which are really dead. I mean, so you have this turbulent evolution of the working class in Malta, beautifully depicted and beautifully done, masterly done, as the base. And then you have this very, very strange...
What reason did you come up with for this?
That's why I called it inconsistencies. Mm. That's why, I mean, because it's the same. It's the same artist, the same craftsman. It's the same idea. I think one of the main problems with Anton Agius is what I called in my book the problem of artistic compromise. Anton Agius was a brilliant abstract sculptor. Passmore was completely infatuated by
Agius. Gosh, I would never have thought that.
Yeah. He was an incredible... He could have become the ultimate of abstract art in Malta, I think, in my opinion. But then, due to the objective now, the context part of it, Malta was passing through beautiful, with all the negative... but beautiful part. I mean, Malta was becoming a nation, right? From the 1960s till today, really. And the independence, the church struggle just before the independence. Then you had the question of Malta Labour Party coming in the 70s, a whole upheaval of previous relations, right? New things, new foreign policy, social welfare state, the black 1980s, and the European stage of Malta. So you have all these, which are beautiful. I mean,
part of the great narrative of
Malta.
Yes, Malta,
yes, it's a beautiful narrative. And so Anton Agius came into the picture from abstract art. He was met frontally with a new Malta. And he decided that abstract art, I mean, he said it quite explicitly many a time and quite publicly. Abstract art, mistakenly, he exclaimed that abstract art cannot reflect this development. Only figurative art can. And he just opted. And I think it's a big mistake, because abstract art could have reflected modern Malta much more than what he thought figurative art. So this compromise, of course, I think created this inconsistency in his works.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Giuseppe Schembri-Bonacci, for coming on the program today
to discuss
the books that you've published in recent years. And I'll have to ask you to come again so that we can have
pleasure. Further
discussion, because it was really fascinating.
Thank you so much. Thanks very much.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom biex xewqat tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.